You're listening to the Alan Gray Podcast. I am Horatia Naidu McCarthy, a manager in the institutional clients team at Alan Gray, and your host for this episode. In April, President Trump's announcement of an array of reciprocal tariffs rocked global stock markets and sent U.S. shares tumbling. It seemed, at least for a moment, that the era of U.S. stock market dominance might be drawing to a close. But after that early April chaos, equities staged a rapid rebound and seemed to be on an even keel. Our colleagues at Orbis have cautioned investors about the hefty price tag attached to many U.S. companies for some time. And the recent volatility reminded investors that paying a premium for optimism can be dangerous. To expand on this, I am joined by my colleague Rob Perrone from our offshore partner Orbis. Rob has been with Orbis since 2011 and is a member of the London-based team of investment specialists responsible for servicing Orbis's clients and consultants. And he's also a member of the multi-asset team. Rob, welcome back to South Africa and thank you for joining me for the very first time on the Alan Gray Podcast.
Thanks, Horatia. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a longtime fan of the podcast.
Well, you have a very interesting educational background. Let's start with what brought you to Orbis.
I didn't study finance. I avoided math as best I could in uni. I studied rhetoric and philosophy. And the typical rhetoric assignment would be find a political speech or find an opinion column or something and sort of analyze what they're up to. And the financial crisis had just happened. And I thought, geez, there must be something interesting here that I can look at. And so looked at the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy hearings, fascinating mud-flinging contest, and then did my thesis on Federal Reserve statements. And then as happens, you know, department head sends around internship opportunities, and I saw one for financial writing intern in Bermuda. And I thought, well, geez, that'd be a nice place to spend the summer. And, you know, I reckon I can write a bit better than the business kids, and I know I like finance more than the writing kids. So I went for it, and lucky for me, Orbis said yes, and then joined after grad school and have been here ever since.
So a true diverse thinker, and I think ascribing to our style of contrarian investor, you know, Orbis's tagline is invest differently. So what does that mean to you and how is it applied in your day to day?
So we describe ourselves as contrarian as well, right? And there's contrarian and then there's driving the wrong way down a one-way street, right? And we don't want to do the latter. We want to have a lot of humility. We think we've got a lot of smart people in the building, but our competitors do too, right? Markets are more or less efficient most of the time in most assets. And so you don't just want to be knee-jerk different or knee-jerk contrarian. I think what it boils down to for us is being fiercely independently minded, forming our own view about what we think makes sense, what we think assets are worth, and then being unafraid to invest behind that conviction and stick through it, even if the market, newspapers, all of our competitors disagree with us in the short term.
So actually, this leads brilliantly into the kind of environment we're finding ourselves in. 2025 has been a really interesting one. So much uncertainty, volatility. People have said, you know, markets have been in an absolute roller coaster. And I think for me, the linchpin was 2nd of April, you know, when Liberation Day was announced. My question is, firstly, did you see it coming? Do you see more of this coming for the year ahead?
So in a sense, everyone saw it coming, right? The guy, he announced he was going to do it on April 2nd. But I think it was clear immediately from the market reaction, the tariffs were worse than markets had feared, right? So everyone knew there would be an announcement. They didn't know it would be that announcement, right? And look, I think, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty. It seems like he hems and haws on tariffs in this nation or that nation, you know, almost daily. And I think the exercise that I see a lot of people in markets doing is there's all this uncertainty and let me pierce through it, right? Let me try to figure out what the end point is going to be and then invest behind that. I think that's a difficult exercise, right? I think it's a low edge exercise. You're unlikely to be able to do it a whole lot better than others. And so we gain that stuff out. We think about it as you do. You can also just step back and say, hey, there is a lot of uncertainty. There is a lot more uncertainty than there was 2 months ago, and it doesn't look like it's going away soon. And rather ask, well, what are the effects of that, right? What are the effects on consumers, on businesses, and so on? We do that exercise, and it leaves us more concerned about asset price valuations, particularly in the U.S.
You know, so you've had this turbulence and how the portfolios held up in this market turbulence, and how much exposure did you actually have to the US, you know, leading into the sort of sell-off that we've seen?
So in our global equity fund, the exposure to US equities is about 36-37%. In our global balanced fund, the exposure net of stock market hedging, we buy the stocks we like and we short the market, so we get the difference. So net of that hedging, in our balanced fund, the exposure is about 8-9%, right? So we're very substantially underweight the US. That's a big liquid place, right? You got thousands of stocks to choose from, so we can find things we like, but we're concerned about the market as a whole. And the funds have broadly performed well. If you think about what's vulnerable, right? What's risky, what's brittle in markets, it's things that have a lot of enthusiasm in the price, right? Where the recent past has been great and the expectation is that the future is going to be even more amazing, right? Very easy for the market to be disappointed when it's already bullish, much less likely to be disappointed if investors were completely neglecting a company, an industry, an entire market, right? We prefer to invest where expectations are lower. So far, since Liberation Day, that's served us pretty well.
You often hear it, and I think it rings true, a key determinant of future returns is starting valuations. So what I'm hearing is you don't want to overpay for these assets going in, and they have been expensive. Even with the sell-off, do you see any opportunities emerging to add to the portfolios? Have you tilted exposures in any way coming out of Liberation Day? What's the thinking been on opportunities in the broader market?
So clients ask me this a lot, and I think the expectation is that if markets are changing rapidly, the portfolio must be changing rapidly too. And it actually hasn't been. We've added to some things, we've trimmed some things. Broadly, the portfolios, the shape is pretty similar to what they were 2 months ago. When you get these periods of volatility, you know, it can be a source of both frustration and excitement for us. It's frustrating because we're competitive, right? We don't like seeing things we own go down in price, particularly if it's for no fundamental reason. But it's a source of excitement because we can then respond to that by going hunting, right? You can say, okay, I thought this was an undervalued company yesterday. Today, the price is 20% lower. I've done my homework. I've worked out that I don't think it's fundamental. Well, I can take advantage of that. I can add to that. I can go hunting and you can take advantage of these periods of volatility.
So you mentioned going hunting. Outside of the US, what looks particularly juicy? What are you hunting? What kind of opportunities are you uncovering?
I mean, the truth is almost anything outside the US looks a bit more reasonable than the US, right? So the S&P today is still on something like 21 times earnings. Stocks outside the US in aggregate can be bought for 15 times, right? So already you're hunting in a more inexpensive shopping mall, right? It's nice. And it's idiosyncratic, right? So there are all sorts of things. So if I think of something that experienced volatility off the back of tariffs that in our view just did not deserve to, I think of a company like Mitsubishi Estate in Japan. Now, what Mitsubishi Estate does is they basically just rent office space in Tokyo. So they've been the landlords of the Marunouchi District, which is kind of the super prime real estate in central Tokyo. It overlooks the Imperial Palace and all that. Some of this property they've owned for 50, 100 years, right? Now, the business is renting Tokyo office space to Tokyo office workers. And you look at it and you say, what does this business have to fear from tariffs? And of course, you do your homework on the balance sheet and all the rest. And the answer that comes back is pretty much nothing, right? Pretty much nothing this business has to fear from tariffs. And yet at one point in March and April, its shares were down 14%, right? And so you see something like that, you're independently minded, you do your homework, it doesn't make sense, you can take advantage of it.
You can't talk about Japan without touching on the yen. The yen's been incredibly weak. I see that the portfolios have an underweight exposure to the US dollar. And so we found the US dollar to be quite expensive. What's the thinking on the yen in particular? And are there any other currencies that are offering relatively more value?
We think the dollar is overvalued against almost any other major world currency, kind of overvalued against sterling, a little bit overvalued versus euro, greatly overvalued versus the yen and the Norwegian kroner. With the yen, the attraction is principally the valuation. Imagine you're buying a company and does it have the highest returns on capital? No. Does it have the best balance sheet? No. But it's trading at like 4 times earnings and like 0.5 times book, right? At a certain point, the valuation just becomes compelling. And on our models, we reckon the US dollar is maybe 40% overvalued versus the yen on a purchasing power basis. And you know, that can sound kind of abstract. I think one colleague of mine, Stefan Somerville, dug up the stat. If you're the average Japanese salary earner at current FX rates, you make less money than a minimum wage employee in New York State. And that's just extreme, right? Misvaluations that are that extreme can't persist forever. If I then step back and say, all right, spend time looking at the bond market, what sort of drives these things? At the moment, Japan has among the higher inflation rates in the developed world. That's extremely unusual, right? Versus the last 20 years, where Japan for most of that time has been struggling against deflation. They have higher inflation. As a result, their central bank is looking towards increasing interest rates at a time when many other central banks are cutting. And what that means is that yen assets offer a relatively more interesting yield than assets elsewhere, right? And that tends to strengthen the currency. We expect that can continue.
And we saw a little bit of that playing out last year with the partial unwind of the yen carry trade and the destabilization of global markets. So now with the central bank looking to increase interest rates, it's time to be a little bit more bullish on the Japanese yen.
I think so. I mean, the principal reason is the valuation, and particularly against the alternative, right? If in currencies, if you're long something, you must be short something else. They're all in pairs, right? But yeah, I mean, the carry trade unwind's an interesting example because I think there's probably plenty of similar stuff going on now, or at least there was in April. Because if you think about it, Japan has NISAs, national savings accounts, modeled on ISAs in the UK. If you're an individual investor in Japan, what's the most popular trade in the world been? Well, take your yen, put it in your NISA, buy dollars with it, and then go buy dollar assets. And that's worked really, really well for a while because you've got higher interest rates in the US, you've had outperforming stock markets in the US, and for most of the last couple of years, you've had strengthening currency, right? You've been winning all three ways. Now, since April, we're seeing at least two legs of that stool come under threat. It wouldn't surprise us to see foreign investors, not just in Japan, but in other places too, start to repatriate some of their money from the U.S. That could weigh on U.S. assets. It could weigh on the U.S. dollar. It might be more supportive for assets in other places.
What's so interesting about this is, on the one hand, the U.S. is no longer your, you know, currency of choice. And a lot of people have started to question, especially during very fearful times, where are the safe haven assets?
I think if there's anything that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we are still talking about from April 2025, it's not going to be the stock market. It's going to be, at some points in April, the S&P 500, U.S. Treasury bonds, and the U.S. dollar were all down at the same time. Now, that's the sort of behavior you expect from an emerging market. Right. In South Africa, it would be like when Zuma fired Nene. It is not the sort of behavior you expect from the world's preeminent stock market, definitive risk-free asset, and global reserve currency. Usually, when things are scary, okay, U.S. stocks are down, but U.S. bonds are up, and the dollar strengthens, right? Because they're seen as a haven. Now, why you see all of those moving in the same direction in emerging markets is because the same thing is driving equities, bonds, and a currency, which is a broad loss of confidence in that country's assets. Where we sit now, the stock market in the U.S. is above where it was on Liberation Day, but the U.S. bond market has not yet recovered. The dollar has not yet recovered. And the way I think about that is equity investors, people who are paid to be bullish all day, are sort of saying, hey, nothing to see here, everything's fine. Bond and currency investors, the people who are paid to worry all day, are a bit more circumspect, right? So that dent to confidence in the U.S. dollar and the U.S. dollar assets, if anything is lasting from April 2025, I think that's likely to be it.
So the multi-asset portfolios like Orbis Global Balanced has had decent exposure to gold. What's the view on gold? It's reached record highs. What are you looking at gold, you know, going forward?
So gold's challenging for us, right? Because we're fundamental investors. We want to run a discounted cash flow model, right? And it doesn't produce cash. And so how do you value it? We look at it a couple of ways. It's a physical metal. So you can just look at supply and demand. Unlike most commodities, humans have been mining gold for thousands of years, right? Which means all the easiest stuff has already been dug up. getting new gold out of the ground is much more expensive than it used to be, which means the miners need a higher price, right, to produce. You can look at it that way. The other way to look at it is, when does gold do well, right? Gold's unique trait, among others, is that it is nobody else's liability. And so when Russia invades Ukraine and the US and its allies more or less confiscate Russia's central bank reserves, other central banks around the world are going, you know, geez, maybe I'm not an adversary of the US, but if they look at me sideways, I lose my reserves. Do I want to own treasuries, or do I rather want to own gold, which is nobody else's liability? And so a lot of gold's strong performance last year was driven by central bank buying. Right, I think of that as buyers who intend to hold it forever were buying. What we weren't yet seeing was financial investors and ETFs buying, and that's picked up pace this year. Right, so gold's been up a lot. Could it come down short term? Sure. We continue to have substantial exposure, but have trimmed a little bit. If you think about it, it's outperformed most of the rest of the fund. And so in the absence of trimming, it would now be a much larger weight than it is. And we've rotated a little bit from the metal to the miners. Now, the miners, in some ways, are a more challenging thing to get a handle on. There's the old joke that a gold mine is a pit in the ground with a liar on top of it, right? And that's been borne out by their track record, right? Every time the gold price goes up, they are anxious to throw the money back into the ground. Their costs balloon. Shareholders never see the benefit in free cash flow. We think certain international miners, including Newmont and Barrick, have kind of got religion on capital allocation and on costs. And so if you plug in the current gold price, the current copper price, because that's a byproduct, and the current oil price, because that's a cost, the miners are trading on prospective free cash flow yields of 8-9%. Now, that's almost triple what you would get in the typical global stock for a company that should be much less correlated with the rest. So that looks compelling to us. And then the final way we think about gold, and one of our favorite characteristics about it is an anti-dollar asset in an environment where confidence in the dollar, confidence in the treasury, confidence in the US-based system looks challenged. If there's less trust in the world, the most trustless asset of all ought to do well, and that's gold.
So what's interesting is the narratives that are driving the stock market. And you spoke about confidence and, you know, this loss of confidence. But to my mind, I think as a fundamental investor, the question I ask of you is, between the sentiment and what you're seeing fundamentally, we've had 15 years of one-way traffic. And many may say, well, you know, this should be the thing that doesn't undo it. And what if U.S. exceptionalism doesn't fade? On the other hand, as a fundamental investor, how are you looking at it?
Look, there are always stories in markets, and there are always disagreeing stories in markets, right? Disagreement is what makes a market, you know? And I think when the narratives that you see in headlines and broker reports and newsletters and so on disagrees with what you see in the price is telling the truth, right? So as investors, that's what we're responding to. Whatever the headlines are saying, we're responding to what's in the price. And lately in the U.S., as you say, right, it's been all one way. American exceptionalism's back. They're just going to keep steamrolling everybody. And prices are high, right? Now, when prices are high, when valuations are high, it means expectations are high. When expectations are high, so is risk. How does the stock price go up or down? If results are better than expected, price goes up. If results are worse than expected, the price goes down. It is way easier for the market to be disappointed when it's already enthusiastic, right? And so we look at that, we look at broad valuations in the US, and it looks a little bit worrying to us. We find it pretty hard to be bullish about the return potential of like a passive US equity allocation.
Because how sustainable is it to get those returns over the next 15 years?
Yeah, so if you roll back 15 years, S&P has done about 13% per annum, which is an extraordinary result. We've only seen that a handful of times in the past century. And you say, well, what's driven that? Some of it is normal stuff. You get a little bit of dividends, companies grow their sales a little bit. A heck of a lot of it has been profit margins going up and valuations going up. Now, both of those are cyclical. They're not stable. They don't move in a straight line. And they're both currently near record highs. And if you say, you know, something like half of your return over the last 15 years came from profit margins going up and valuations getting more expensive, you shouldn't expect that to repeat. You know, the S&P is on 21, 22 times earnings now. If you want the same boost from rising valuations that you got recently, you got to think the PE ratio is going to hit 40. Now, it just doesn't seem realistic to us. And I think another component of U.S. exceptionalism has been just the equity outperformance. Some of that is deserved, right? Some of that is fundamental. American companies have grown earnings in aggregate more quickly than companies elsewhere. Yeah, they deserve a bit of outperformance. And I'll speak to people and I'll say, look, the stocks outside the U.S. are so much cheaper. And they say, yeah, but American companies are better, right? They deserve a premium. And that's true, right? They do. If you gave me that U.S. stocks versus ex-U.S. stocks at the same price, probably I'd take the U.S. They deserve some premium. What they don't deserve is an ever-increasing premium. And from today's starting point, when so much of a premium is already baked in, to believe you're going to get great returns out of passive U.S. exposure, you got to believe that premium is just going to get wider, and that doesn't seem realistic to us.
So there has been a criticism for the Orbis portfolios that they've been very defensively positioned and that the cautious positioning may have resulted in, you know, costing us an outperformance or alpha opportunities. Can you give us some insight into the thinking that went into the positioning of these portfolios?
If you're cautious or if you're aggressive, you're referring to risk, right? And how do we think about risk? We view it as the permanent loss of our clients' capital. Not volatility, not short-term underperformance, but the permanent loss of capital. And we think the best way to lose money is to overpay for an asset. And so our first line of defense on risk, when we think about being cautious, the first thing we're thinking about is insisting on only buying securities at a discount to intrinsic value, right? That's what we aim to do. We don't want to take valuation risk. And are we calibrated, right? Well, look, I would rather be a little bit too cautious than a little bit too aggressive, right? You can be a bull market hero, right? And say, oh, wow, look at all the outperformance I've generated. It must be that I'm a great stock picker. No, you've just taken more risk, right? And so we don't want to be in that camp. That said, you know, we want to be humble, right? Every year, even in the best year Orbis has ever had, we miss loads of securities that perform well, you know? If you look at 2022, it was a pretty good year for the balance fund. Just run a list of the best performing shares globally. We didn't own most of them, and yet we delivered good results. Our goal is not to own every security in the world that performs well. Our goal is to ensure that the securities we do own are fundamentally attractive, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
Orbis Global Balanced has certainly been an interesting one. I think a lot of our peers have been surprised about, you know, its outperformance. What kind of levers were pulled in that portfolio to really hold up in a quite a volatile market?
Yeah, well, if you say levers are pulled, it suggests that, like, oh, we're seeing the volatility and then, you know, we're like on a ship and we're spinning around the wheel rapidly. And that's not really the case, right? Jim Grant, he's a commentator, runs Grant's Interest Rate Observer, has this great line. He said, successful contrarian investing is all about having everybody agree with you later. And if I think about what's driven the performance of the balance fund, it's not that we were rapidly changing stuff in the months where we were delivering good returns. It's that the stuff we held for a year, multiple years, and the market had come around and started to share our view. If I think of the two most prominent examples, we have very substantial positions in energy infrastructure, right? So everyone's talking about the energy transition. People are very anxious to invest behind batteries or electric vehicles, the visible stuff, you know, wind farms, solar panels. When capital is rushing into an area, it becomes like a money-throwing contest. And the way to earn a good return on capital is to go where it's scarce. And we looked at the energy system, we looked at what was changing, and we thought, you know, there's a lot of neglect here. Sure, you know, windmills are great. You might need more natural gas power to back those up. Siemens Energy, which we've held for a long time, is one of the leading manufacturers of natural gas turbines. Mitsubishi Heavy Industries in Japan is one of the leading manufacturers of natural gas turbines. Kinder Morgan transports most of the natural gas into the U.S. And going out of the U.S. through liquefied natural gas. So we looked at these things and we saw, man, you can't get from A to B without some of these companies. You know, people talk about data centers and all the energy demand that's going to come from those. And we're very anxious to invest behind, you know, people whose products are in the data center building. You can't get a data center connected in Northern Virginia right now because the backlog on electrical transformers runs to 2 years, right? Siemens Energy is one of the largest makers of those too. So the energy transition, energy infrastructure is one place where we were positioned, one way that was contrary to the market narrative, and the market has come around to our view. In other words, defense and aerospace contractors. Now, we had positions in these before Russia invaded Ukraine, not because we had a crystal ball and we knew that that was going to happen, but you could look around the world and you could see conflict bubbling up, right? Whether that's China and the South China Sea or with Taiwan, whether it's Saudi Arabia and Iran and their proxies getting into scuffles, whether it was Russia invading Crimea, right? And we looked at it, we looked at Europe in particular, which had rapidly cut defense spending since the end of the Cold War, said this isn't sustainable, right? Europe's going to have to be able to look after itself. Defense spending is going to have to go up. And when it does, it's going to be local champions who benefit the most from that. And so, you know, that included Rheinmetall, which we've been trimming aggressively. That included BAE Systems, now Leonardo in Italy, among others. It's not about changing rapidly. It's about forming a view. And if you're right, you might have to wait. The waiting might be uncomfortable. But if the market eventually comes around to your view, that's when you see it in performance.
I think what's really interesting beyond the contrarian ideas you're finding in the portfolios is particularly for your multi-asset. We do it a lot differently to our peers in how we put the portfolios together. Can you talk us through how the portfolios are constructed?
As a family of firms or bottom-up investors, right? The key unit of decision-making, the key unit of research, the key building blocks are always individual securities. And everyone's sort of cool with that when you're an equity fund. Like, of course, you're bottom-up. You're a stock picker. You pick your 20 or 30 stocks and off you go. As soon as you step into the multi-asset space, people start to think in buckets. And it starts to be less about individual securities and more about, you know, I've got this big lever. And the key question is, how much do I have in equities and how much do I have in bonds? And that's not how we operate, right? We rather say which individual stocks and bonds look most compelling and how can we combine those into a portfolio with the best balance of risk and return, right? It's a very different way of doing it. But what it means is that you can manage risk, you can enhance returns in many more ways than you could if you were just using big buckets, you know? And so something like Taiwan Semiconductor, we think it's probably the most dominant physical business in the world. It makes all of NVIDIA's chips, so NVIDIA cannot grow unless TSMC is also growing. It is the only company today capable of building leading-edge computer chips at scale. We think it can grow 15%+ for the foreseeable future, but we can buy it for maybe 19 times earnings, right? For a similar quality company, you'd be looking at paying 30 or more in the US. Now, why is it inexpensive? Well, because it's on an island, right? Very close to China, that China views as part of its own, right? And so what about conflicts in Taiwan? Well, if you're managing the portfolio bottom up, you can think about this in all sorts of different ways. We can hedge the currency. Something bad happens to TSMC, it's going to be rough for the rest of Taiwan too. We can hedge the equity market directly if we want to. Or we can own different businesses that might counterbalance anything bad happening to TSMC. And so we own Samsung. We all know them as a smartphone manufacturer. Actually, usually their biggest business is in semiconductors and computer chips. They're strong in memory. They also have a business that competes with TSMC to make logic chips, sort of the brains of a computer, if you like. And that unit's been losing money, right? They've been trying to keep up with TSMC and it's hard and they've been losing money. But something bad happens to TSMC, what's going to happen to Samsung? They're the next best game in town. They won't be able to keep up with the intake of orders for logic chips. And so when you're building the portfolio from the bottom up, you have many more angles, many more lenses with which you can think about risk, many more ways to mitigate those risks.
So this constant competition for capital between your equities and your fixed income means that you're likely to look quite different to the benchmark. We've spoken a little bit about equities. What does your fixed income exposure look like?
So let me start with what the benchmark's fixed income exposure looks like, which is 40% government bonds. Now, until 2022, that was a very hard benchmark. You know, I can remember speaking to clients in 2016, 17, 18. I was jumping up and down. I couldn't believe how low yields were and that people were still allocating to them. And yet yields just kept going lower, right? In 2022, that started to reverse. It's having wobbles now too. We look at the debt situation in the US, and not just the US, you know, look at France, the UK is so-so, Japan's not great. We have concerns about nominal government bonds. And so we are underweight fixed income overall. We hold virtually no long-term nominal bonds. The long-term bonds we do own are inflation-linked US treasuries called TIPS. Now, in our view, having an inflation-linked bond ought to be a little bit lower risk, because if you think about the debt situation, many of the ways that are attractive to deal with that, if you're a politician, end up being inflationary. If you're in a nominal bond, you know, inflation is the bond assassin. It kills you. If you're an inflation-linked bond, you're protected, right? And so where we sit today, a long-term inflation-linked bond in the U.S. will give you about a 2.5% real return. That's locked in after inflation in U.S. dollars. If you look over a very long history, that's actually better than bonds have usually done. But you say, okay, I'm paying the government for inflation insurance. You know, where is that insurance struck? And the market's inflation expectation is about 2.3% today. And that's on the consumer price index. If you use the Fed's measure, that's almost bang on 2%. So the market is saying central banks are going to get inflation right where they want it to be, and it's going to stay there forever. And now that looks complacent to us. We think the risks to inflation are to the upside, much more comfortable having that protection. In addition to U.S. inflation-linked bonds, we've also picked up some government bonds in other maybe more esoteric corners. We have sovereign bonds in Norway. That's one where we like the currency. You think about the debt situation in the U.S., well, Norway is exactly the opposite. They have a massive sovereign wealth fund worth multiples of GDP. And so it would be like investing in a company that has a lot of net debt on its balance sheet versus one that's holding a big pile of net cash, right? It gives us a lot of confidence that the Norwegian kroner should be a good store of value. And so its bonds look interesting. Another is Iceland. Now, if you go to visit Iceland, you'll walk around, and for all intents and purposes, you'll very much feel that you're in a developed market. Not how it's categorized by index providers, who still regard it as a frontier market, because of some follow-on effects from what Iceland suffered during the global financial crisis. And we look at that and say, well, okay, maybe index investors can't participate because it has this label attached, but we can, and we can pick up a much higher yield than what we would get in U.S. treasuries or other assets. That higher yield is not really reflecting higher risk in our view, and so that looks compelling.
What you're describing is a portfolio that's quite different. And I think one of the considerations for an investor is, how does this portfolio fit in an overall solution, or how does it make sense for me as an investor to think about this portfolio? So from the perspective of finding places in which to find some measure of safety, diversification, we're starting to see that emerge. How have you looked at the portfolio relative to our peers?
So when we look at our portfolio versus indices or peers, often we focus on what we disagree with. But if you're an investor in funds, that disagreement means that we play very well with others. If you have a passive fund, when the index is doing well, maybe we're a little bit frustrated, but okay, the index is doing well. When the passive fund is not doing well, we're probably doing a bit better. Likewise, if you can find, you know, a high quality growth manager, different style to us, they would go crazy trying to do what we do. We would go crazy trying to do what they do, but different approaches can work. If you combine both of us, you can often get a smoother ride and enhance your long-term returns. Now, I think what we offer that's scarce, that's rare, is being focused on intrinsic value. You know, there were times, we had a slide a couple of years back saying a picture of a value-oriented investor in 2006. It was a picture of Einstein. Value-oriented investor in 2021, it was a little kid with a dunce cap, right? Not looking very happy. There aren't many value-oriented investors left for people to choose from. And so we think if you look at your portfolio, many of the big funds you hold, whether they're active or passive, are likely to own really similar stuff. if we look at the competitors for our global equity fund, most of them are loaded up on the top 10 shares in the index. And so you're looking at your statement, you say, oh, I'm diversified across four managers. If they all own the same stuff, the returns are all going to behave the same way, right? We are very different. The portfolios are different. Therefore, the path of returns is different. Long-term, we expect it to be superior. We expect it to be better. But along the way, that can also give you a smoother ride.
It's interesting you touched on inflation earlier, and it seems like with your TIPS exposure in the portfolio, you actually expect inflation to sort of surprise in the upside. Recently, you put together a few really interesting charts showing the long-term structural drivers of inflation. Can you talk us through a little bit about the thinking that went into that?
Sure. I saw a wonderful study a while ago looking at Federal Reserve officials, and it seemed to conclude that the only thing you need to know is someone going to be really worried about inflation, or are they going to be more relaxed about inflation? The only thing you really need to know is the year of their birth. If they grew up in a high inflation environment, they will be concerned about inflation for the rest of their lives. If they didn't, they won't. And think about the environment we've had for the last 20 years. Inflation has been low and predictable. Everyone's gotten used to it. You know, if you've only been in markets 15, 20 years, it's all you've ever known, right? And so we look out, we see enormous confidence in central banks. We're a little bit suspect of that, because what kept inflation so nice and low and predictable over the last 20 years? You had these big, powerful forces, right? So you had globalization. It has many, many justified and warranted criticisms. The one thing it is really good at is pushing down costs. Now, I don't think anyone listening to this thinks the world is getting more globalized than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So that trend is at least stopped, and it's probably reversed. Another would be the swing in power away from labor, away from workers, towards companies, towards corporate profits. That can only go on so long before you begin to get political blowback. You know, last year, on both sides of the Atlantic, we saw like a big increase in strike action, people agitating for higher wages, and inflation can feed into that, right? If you're facing, you know, a higher bill for your groceries, you want to go to your boss and say, hey, I need more money, right? My standard of living is suffering. And so we think that one is probably stopped and perhaps reversing too. Another one I'd call out is defense spending. Now, in our view, defense spending is inherently inflationary, because what you're doing is you're pushing money into private sector hands, but you're not doing anything to increase the supply of goods and services available to consumers. So you have more money chasing the same goods and services, it's likely to be inflationary. As these forces stop or reverse, the things that held inflation down to a nice predictable 2% are going to go away, right? And so we think maybe 3.5% long-term is a more realistic expectation than the 2% that we see reflected in market prices.
And any level of Trump's tariffs is definitely going to be inflationary.
I don't know about definitely. First order effect, yeah, prices go up and it's less efficient. And so perhaps growth goes down. But then you must consider the second order effects, right? At a point in April, it looked as though the US and China basically had embargoes versus one another. Now, okay, maybe that leads to price increases. It can also lead to empty shelves, right? It can also lead to, you know, if you're a supply chain dependent on parts from China, you can't produce, right? It hurts growth. Hurts growth, and therefore it hurts demand pull inflation too. And the other thing is tariffs. Yes, if you say, hey, everything that you import is 10% more expensive than it used to be on account of tariffs, that's not 10% ongoing inflation. It's a step change, right? It's a one-off step change. And so, yeah, I think tariffs probably are cost push inflationary, but they have other effects too. And once you start getting into the second and third order effects, it all gets a bit messy. One reason why when we're making decisions in the fund, we want to focus on the decisions where we have an edge, right? I think we've got much more of an edge if we're looking at one individual business that we understand really well versus trying to make big, big, big bets on some of these macro forces where, you know, there's only a couple of assets and every investor in the world cares about them. We want to stick to our knitting.
I think China's starting to look a little bit more interesting. We chatted about some of the names that are looking compelling and perhaps finding their ways into the portfolios. Is there anything that comes to mind that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, so one in our balance fund is called Anta Sports, which is basically the Nike of China. Again, you know, I was saying with Mitsubishi Estate, these things sell off and they don't deserve to, right? The Anta, 90% of their revenues are domestic. 90% of their revenues in China. Almost all of their costs are also in China, right? So you have domestic cost, domestic revenue. What does this business have to fear from tariffs? You know, in our view, not much. And yet its shares were down 26% at one point in March and April. And you look at the long-term history of the business, and we've got these charts we like to run. You know, we're long-term investors, so we like to look at companies over a long history. And we've got these charts which will show the fundamentals, right? And Mark Dunleavy-Owen, who's a member of the multi-asset team, put a comparison together. And he said, which one of these do you think is Anta? Which do you think is Nike? And which do you think is Hermes, right? Which is just about the most beautiful, high-quality fundamental chart you can see. And Anta is borderline indistinguishable. You know, its historical track record in terms of return on capital, earnings growth, growth in free cash flow, stability of margins, looks more like Hermes than it does like a low-quality cyclical business. And yet we can buy it at an enormous discount, right? And so it's things like that, where if you're willing to have a broader perspective than others, if you're willing to do your homework on names that other investors neglect, you can find very high quality businesses available at good prices. And we love that today, right? So we looked today and we said, geez, if you had to build a portfolio using indices or using ETFs, you know, it wouldn't be too enthusiastic. We might even be mad at you. But if you're building it with individual companies, you know, the world is not uniformly expensive. It's not that every stock in stock markets is expensive today. There are big, big parts of stock markets that have been neglected and where we think the shares offer both lower risk and higher expected returns.
I'm seeing a nice little trend forming where you've got two companies that you've mentioned, Mitsubishi Estate and Anta, both heavily reliant on domestic revenue. And so what I'm hearing is a bit of an insulation from tariffs, should there be an ongoing concern. If we shift our attention away from Japan and China, you know, Europe's starting to look a little bit interesting. Not only are they, you know, finally finding their independence away from the US on the defense front, but those European stock markets have been incredibly depressed for a long time. And for, you know, valuation type investors like yourselves, it's a great place to go hunting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and you just think about like a good gut check on our expectations high or low, you know, roll back a year or two. Was anyone waking up in the morning thinking, oh, you know how I'm going to get rich? European equities, right? Nobody was bullish, right? And there are pockets in Europe that are more expensive, that are more highly valued. You have the luxury goods companies. You have ASML, which makes lithography machines for manufacturing semiconductors. TSMC is by far its biggest customer. It trades at 50% higher multiple than TSMC. You have the pharma companies, right, which saw a spike in sentiment following all these weight loss drugs. And so there are pockets in Europe that look richly priced, but many of the shares do not, right? And many of them have been neglected. That's true in continental Europe. It's also true in the UK. I'm based in London. And UK investors seem to hate their own stock market. And we can't fathom why, right? You can find pretty high quality businesses, you know, 10, 15% returns on equity, trading at single digit PE multiples. And the other thing we like about the UK is that it's a high dividend yielding culture. You know, if you think about the path, the experience of being a contrarian investor in a stock, you work out what you think it's worth, and maybe it's trading at 8x earnings and you reckon fair would be 15, you got to wait for the market to agree with you, right? And that can be testing. It is a little bit less testing if along the way you're collecting a 4, 5, 6% dividend yield. And so some of our names in the UK look really compelling from that respect. The other interesting thing in the UK is that things get punished just for having the UK label. Right, so something like Balfour Beatty, which is a construction company, a lot of its revenues are outside the UK. Right, it is at least as much a US business as it is a UK business. Now, unfortunately for its shareholders, it's listed in London. Right, we look at that. We look at other things. We compare the London listed company to the US peer. The US peer might be on double the price multiple. Right, double the valuation. That to us suggests there's a fundamental disconnect. If we can be on the cheap side of that, we will be.
fundamental disconnect is an interesting way to put the way I personally feel about something like cryptocurrency. But we keep getting the question about crypto. And, you know, could it be a safe haven when markets, you seem fearful about markets, gold so richly priced? What's the view on crypto? And would you put it in the portfolio if you could?
So it's not my call, but no. Look, I think there's a chance that the Bitcoin ends up being something like digital gold. We'll see. It certainly hasn't behaved that way. If you look at the way its price behaves, it looks rather a lot more like the NASDAQ than it does like gold, right? It's a speculative asset. People want to get rich quick. But where all the action has been is not actually in Bitcoin. It's in all these meme coins, right? And at least Bitcoin has something like a consistent use case. The others, yeah, I wouldn't touch them with a barge pole. You know, I think anything that doesn't produce cash flows, including gold, very difficult to put an intrinsic value on it. But a made-up asset whose price seems to be fueled by speculative enthusiasm would not be my first choice for a safe haven.
So Orbis has long held an underweight to the Magnificent Seven, those big US tech names. How constructive are you on artificial intelligence or AI looking ahead? It certainly has become a very dominant theme.
Look, it's a great example of when you focus on valuation, because often we don't disagree with the enthusiastic stories that you see in the market, the enthusiastic stories driving the prices of popular shares. Don't disagree with the story. The question is, what do we have to pay for it, right? What do we have to pay to participate? And something like AI, since you get in markets, is it sort of NVIDIA and Microsoft, and through Microsoft, OpenAI. NVIDIA is going to print money, and Microsoft's going to print money. Well, TSMC manufactures all of NVIDIA's chips, right? NVIDIA cannot grow unless TSMC also grows. TSMC is available at a 1/3 discount to NVIDIA. It looks more compelling to us. The other way we think about it is just look at the value chain, right? So NVIDIA pays TSMC to make chips. Okay. Microsoft pays TSMC for those chips. Now it needs a return on its investment. It's going to try to get that return by selling AI services. Well, who does it sell them to? It sells them to the rest of the corporate world. Well, they need a return on investment on their AI services spending, right? So I think either it's going to work for everybody, and the beneficiaries are going to be far broader than the big names you see in the press, or everyone else is not going to get enough value out of AI, and thus Microsoft is not going to get a good enough return on its capital investment, NVIDIA is going to struggle, and so on. The other thing I look at here is people focus on the revenue growth, the revenue opportunity. Costs go into that. If you roll back a couple of years, the big talk about all these tech companies, oh, they're capital light businesses. They're capital light. They can grow without investing a lot of CapEx. If you dig into the quarterly reports of Microsoft, of Alphabet, of Meta, they're now making tweaks to depreciation terms, right? How quickly do we depreciate our chips, right, on our balance sheet? If depreciation is a major concern, you're talking about a more capital intensive business, perhaps a lower quality business going forward than what they were in the past. So broadly, don't disagree with the story. AI probably will change the world. NVIDIA probably will grow pretty quickly. The question is, what do we have to pay? And can we buy these companies at a discount? At the moment, we don't think the opportunity to participate is in the Magnificent Seven. We think we can participate in a much better way in companies like TSMC.
So Rob, as we bring this conversation to a close, what would you think is the most important ways in which to navigate global markets that look to be incredibly uncertain, seeing the volatility you've seen so far this year?
I think you want to seek low expectations. When expectations are high, so is risk. They look high in the US. Outside the US, they look much, much more reasonable. And then step two, get actually diversified. Right. Don't bet the farm on a particular outcome because you think you can guess better than the next guy what Trump is going to do. You probably can't. Right. Rather be diversified, own things with low expectations. You can both reduce your risk and enhance your long-term returns.
So thank you to Rob for joining me for this conversation. Three takeaways from my perspective. You know, as Ben Preston at Orbis always says, share prices can only fight for so long against a gravitational pull of fair value. The second takeaway is diversifying in correlated, incredibly expensive markets becomes so important. And the third is starting valuations actually matter. And by seeking low expectations, we have the ability to have a real impact on long-term returns. And like the book Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, expectations frequently come out differently from the way in which we plan. But we always do our best anyway. By sticking to process, in the long run, it tends to be rewarded, often from very unexpected directions. If you'd like to get in touch, please send an email to info@alangray.co.za. You can also subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Alan Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit alangray.co.za. Until next time, I am Horatia Naidu McCarthy. Thank you for listening. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
There's a song that goes, "Money can't buy me love." And that's true. But then they told us all you need is love, which anybody with a mortgage will tell you most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Alan Gray, long-term investing. Alan Gray is an authorized FSP.